Hello, and a warm welcome back to you all. This is the Gita Decoded, and we are now on Chapter 9 of the Gita Decoded, which deals, as you know, with the yoga of royal knowledge and of royal mystery. We have gone through the first half, you can say, of this chapter, and Sister Denise, our speaker, will take us through the rest of it to share what she understood from its text. Sister Denise, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
At the end of the last episode, we stopped at verse 10, and we're now going into verse number 11, which reads, "The deluded despise me, clad in human form, not knowing my higher being as the great Lord of beings." The use of words here I find interesting, because it says, the deluded despise me, clad in human form. That's quite poetically put. What is the reason?
When God incarnates, you know, there are many incarnations, and it is said that the last incarnation is Kalki Avatar.
Which means?
Kalki Avatar means he's riding a black horse, wearing white, with a big sword, and dashing through the world. Kalki means like Kali Yuga, Kala, black. So it seems to me that it's referring to that when God comes and incarnates, he wears the body of an iron-aged person. And this is why the deluded would despise that. So it's not just only a human form. Human means not a deity, so Krishna is a deity, so he's not clad in the form of a deity, he's not actually in the body of Krishna, the very visible deity. If you would see Krishna, you would know this is Krishna. So deluded or undeluded, there's no question of despising. But I think that if God comes in the ordinary body of an iron-aged person, then he would be completely invisible. You would just see the body, the iron-aged human body, because you wouldn't know that this is a higher being, the great Lord of beings, the supreme soul, the father of all souls. So to me, this is a especially interesting verse because it corresponds in a very extraordinary way to the idea that we have in Brahma Kumaris, that Brahma Baba, whom we call Brahma Baba Prajapita Brahma, is the instrument for the incorporeal Shiva to give the knowledge of the Gita at the end of the Kalpa once again. And so I find it very interesting that already in the Gita this is understood, that God is very, very heavily disguised. And you find this in other scriptures, in other faith traditions, the idea of God disguised as a Brahmin, actually, you get that, and that nobody recognizes him because he is just wearing the dress, the costume, the body of an ordinary person. So you actually need that special eye to see now who is contained within this ordinary form.
In verse 12, there is a lot of mention of vanity as an obstacle, and which forms an essential part of this delusion. Those of vain hopes, vain actions, vain knowledge, devoid of discrimination, abide in a fiendish and demoniacal nature, which is deluding. What it says to me is that their own pride, false pride, is the reason that they cannot see what God is. Do you understand it differently?
No, I would definitely go with that. Vanity, it is also said, you know, that when God comes, there are many false gods. Mm. And this you find in the Christian Bible and some other places as well. Pride in a person who says, you know, I'm the one. And there are lots of people who think, you know, I'm it. And this is talking about it.
Sister Denise, I have to ask you this question in this context. Has it been your experience that God comes himself onto earth? Not having taken human birth, not having come as historically it's been said he came, but does he come himself?
It is my experience that he comes himself and he comes into relationship. I don't think you can come into relationship with God to that degree unless he comes. You can have a relationship with a concept, which is different from having a relationship with a being. Mm. But, you know, God is not human. So for a human being to have a relationship with a non-human being and know who that non-human being is, who is heavily disguised when comes, that is very lucky. Hmm. So that's my experience, yeah.
Given the emphasis on vanity in the 12th verse, what does it take to recognize him if he comes in a disguised human form?
My personal feeling is that we, iron-aged, Tamil Pradhan people, do not have the capacity to recognize God. And the fact that one does recognize God, I mean, how come one would recognize and another one wouldn't? There are so many factors. But I do feel that God tracks everybody and knows who's what, who has love for him. And I think that God makes it possible for someone to recognize, like open a window and close again quickly. Because all of those of us who do feel that, yes, we did recognize God, we have recognized God, how is that possible? You don't really know. But you just say that, yeah, this is the one. How do you know? Can't say. You can't make somebody recognize by convincing them and whatnot. Or if somebody has recognized, nobody can convince them otherwise. So it's a very extraordinary phenomenon, I would say.
Verse 13, but those souls who are great, Arjuna, partaking of a celestial nature, worship me, capital M, single-mindedly, knowing me as the origin of beings and as the imperishable. That is answers, well, my previous question to an extent, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The category of souls who are able to recognize God, even though he comes in a disguised form. What is the hallmark then, Sister Denise, the characteristics of such souls? Define celestial nature, define what is meant by great soul, worship me single-mindedly. It's impressive to find somebody who does that, because whoever does the worshipping, they still have a life here on earth and they worship single-mindedly anyway.
It's quite difficult to define, really, because I think there are many people who are, you know, intensely pure and loving to God, but they wouldn't describe themselves like that. They just think they're normal like everybody else. But yet, they have a very, very special love for God. And I see two characteristics. One is great love for God, and then great love for humanity. So such people, they really want to do good things, they want to be of service, and they just want to be close to God, to be like God, to be loved by God, and everything else is actually a bit secondary. They will do everything else, but this is really the deep inner motive. They may not speak about it, but is there.
The next few verses gives a very detailed description of God revealing himself, and there are far too many to go into. But what captured my attention is verse 18. I am the goal, the supporter, the great Lord, and the witness. God is a witness. The abode, the refuge, the friend, the origin, the dissolution, and the foundation, the treasure house, and the imperishable seed. And there's far more titles before this, but if we have to go through each and every one of those titles, we'll be sitting here for a very long time, and unfortunately we have a time constraint. But Sister Denise, it's very interesting, that line, the witness. What do you understand by that entire stanza?
I think it makes it very clear that God is not the one who does everything. You know, there are people who do say that God split himself into many, many pieces, and everything that anybody does is actually God doing it. Because the witness means, okay, I set it up, I'm the creator, I set up the creation, which is a machine, and it runs by itself, and he watches it dispassionately. At the end of the process, you know, God is also the teacher. And I think part of what the teacher does is will give the, you know, knowledge to students that here is your information, and then there are exams. And so the teacher cannot interfere in the exams, but you will get a grade, you know.
Verse 19, I radiate heat, I withhold and send forth the rain. I am both immortality and death, being and non-being, Arjuna. That I found it difficult to understand. Could you explain it to the viewer?
I think this stanza refers to the concept of omnipresence of God. And in fact, I would say that, you know, you can't be the witness on one hand and, you know, these other things. It says, I am both immortality and death. I am being and non-being. It really stating that everything, living, non-living, etc., all of that is God. And I think it is a mixing of the individual supreme being with the energy of matter, which is actually described as a very good description of the energy of matter. I mean, the raining and not raining depends on the movement of the energies around the earth, the currents in the oceans, the currents above the clouds, and all this. This is the energy of matter.
So, Sister Denise, there is something like accurate praise and inaccurate praise.
There is accurate praise and inaccurate praise. I mean, praise means description. But the thing is, you see, I do feel that the Gita has been written by many different people. Some of it is Vedantic, some of it not, you know, and it's come together in a very beautiful poetic way. And the presence of these contradictions makes it quite difficult to say anything hard and fast about it. I think the advantage that we have in the Brahma Kumaris is that we're receiving a teaching which is said to come from the incorporeal Supreme Being through the physical medium of Prajapita Brahma, and also Brahma Baba, as we call him, had demonstrated with his life how do you actually embody this, how do you practice this, how do you live this. And so with these two things, we feel that we have a very good key to be able to interpret what is being said and how to use it and which parts correspond to the idea of omnipresence and which parts correspond to the idea of the actual being of God who interacts with humanity and nature. So you have this threefold interaction of the energy of God, the energy of souls, and the energy of matter.
So Denise, I now want to focus on verses 20 and 21. Those who know the three Vedas, the Soma drinkers, S-O-M-A drinkers, those whose evils are cleansed, worship me with sacrifices and seek to go to heaven. They, attaining the pure world of Lord of the Gods, enjoy in heaven the God's celestial pleasures. Having enjoyed the vast world of heaven, they enter the world of mortals when their merit is exhausted. Thus comforting to the law of the three Vedas, desiring enjoyments, they obtain the state of going and returning. Give us your take on this, because there's a lot of words here, a lot of information, and it also defines to me the impact of having been involved with God. Mm-hmm. Then it actually changes soul's experience. Well, take us through that, please.
Yeah, to me, this corresponds to a very good description of how the human soul interacts with God, as a result of which goes to the world of heaven, the Golden Age and Silver Age, Satyug, Treta Yug, and when that is completed, then they have to become mortal. And then they enter Dwapur Yuga and then Kali Yuga, which is called the game of going and returning, Avagaman Kakil, which means incarnating, reincarnating. And in the second half of the cycle, your lifespan is very short, so you incarnate, reincarnate very quickly. Going back to verse 20, Soma is the nectar of immortality, which is the knowledge. And one of the titles of Shiva is Somnath. And Somnath, the Lord of Soma, the first gift of incorporeal God to humanity is the gift of knowledge. And so the Soma drinkers, those who drink the nectar of knowledge, they definitely are going through the purification process, so their evils are cleansed. They remember God. It is mentioned here with sacrifices, so the yagya, the sacrificial fire of knowledge in which the consciousness of the body is finished, destroyed. And as a result, they reach the Golden Age, Silver Age, they reach heaven. And so this is the creation of the Lord of the Gods. So Lord of the Gods means incorporeal God, gods with small g. This is the population of the Golden Age, with special reference to the kings and queens. And of course, they will enjoy the celestial pleasures of the Golden Age, no doubt. And they have 21 births in the Satyuga and Treta Yuga, according to the knowledge of the cycle that we study in Brahma Kumaris. Once their energy is completed, then, the capacity for immortality of the soul, which is seen in the Golden Age and Silver Age, that's finished, and the soul falls. This idea also, the Bible of falling from heaven. So the soul falls into body consciousness, from soul consciousness, and then mentioning the law of the Vedas, and the Vedas correspond quite well to many of the concepts in science, in particular entropy, you know, that the energy gets exhausted and dissipated. Though they may desire all the enjoyments of heaven, but they have to go through the process of reincarnation in the Copper Age and Iron Age, where they will fall lower and lower and lower until we get to where we are now, the Iron Age, where you wish to overcome your limitations and be free from your vices through the intercession of God Himself. So I find these two verses very interesting because they correspond very well to the ideas that we study.
Verse 22, those men who worship directing their thoughts to me, whose minds do not go elsewhere, for them who are constantly steadfast, I secure what they lack and preserve what they already possess. Those last two lines are wow. I secure what they lack and preserve what they already possess. Now that is a divine blessing from God Himself.
It is.
That's one of those humbling experiences, just to read this.
Yes. So you see how much love God has for His children.
Yeah, that's quite palpable. Is there anything else you want to share on that before we move on?
Well, I think that it really explains the reciprocity of God. You know, you love God, you remember God, and whatever is missing in you, He will fill it up so that you actually come to Him in a state of being like Him so that you can be with God. You know, being with God means you have to be on a similar level. The one who is totally focused on God and absorbs everything from God, they become like God. And so whatever is missing, His love is to bring that to that level.
I find verse 23 rather interesting. It reads, even those who worship other gods with faith, small g, not capital, also worship me, Arjuna, capital M, though they do so in ignorance. That's almost contradictory, but yet not.
No, I don't find it contradictory. I mean, the thing is this, you have to also see this is very much the scripture of India, which is pantheistic. Mm. And so there are many gods with small g. And then there is one incorporeal God with big G. Yeah. Of course, the big and small letter is only in English lettering. If a person worships God as he is, who he is, that means they know. If a person worships some other divinity, thinking that is God, that means they're ignorant. But they have good faith, you see. So what God is looking at is the faith and the good faith of a person. Well, they really believe that this particular divinity is God. So God will say, okay, well, that's fine. And here's the reward of your sincere devotion.
The last two lines of verse 24 mention the consequence of that. It says, but they do not recognize me in truth, hence they fall. That is very clear.
If you recognize God, there is a huge merit in that because you can hold on to God. If you are remembering something or someone who's not God as God, they will not be able to hold you, support you in time of crisis, and this is why you will fall. But if you have connection with real God, and you hold on, it will hold you up.
Verse 25 is very thought-provoking to me in terms of the law of karma. Those who are devoted to the gods go to the gods, both small g. Those who are devoted to the ancestors go to the ancestors, both small a. Those who are devoted to the spirits go to the spirits. Those who worship me come surely to me. The curious thing about the first three categories is that those souls believe that they are going to God directly, but they're not.
The thing is this, there's blind faith, which doesn't have the merit of recognition. It's not the same. Now God is very reciprocal. Everything is calculated in terms of the law of karma. So if you are ignorant and you have a blind faith that so-and-so is God, who actually isn't God, then okay, that's where you'll go. But if you really want God, and you really want to know who is God, and you do the work of reaching God, then you will go to God. So to me, it's very logical, and it also shows you that there is a hierarchy of souls, and souls are not equal. All the souls are equally points of light, but after that, they're all, we use the term number-wise, they're all in order.
Again, the law of karma comes to mind when I read verse 26. He who offers to me with devotion and a pure heart, a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, that offering of devotion I accept from him. That is heartwarming, because millions of people in this country and abroad will resonate with this.
It's beautiful, because it just means that God is looking at the love in your heart, not really concerned about you've got a good intellect or whatever. He's really responding to the love of a person for him, because the whole thing about your relationship with God is love and remembrance. You know, it's not a theoretical thing. It's a deep movement from the heart of the devotee to God. And if the devotee doesn't quite get it, doesn't matter, because it's the spirit, you know, with which it is done that matters.
We have to stop right there, unfortunately. So there you have it. We spoke in chapter 9 of the relationship between God and his children, his children. We also look at what God's message is to us, and how he very specifically and clearly states the types of remembrance we can have of him, and the consequences of such remembrance. So, very deep message contained in the second part of chapter 9. We haven't finished with this chapter. We'll continue with it on the next occasion, and we hope to see you again soon. Sister Denise, many blessings, and thank you.
Thank you.
So, take care to you at home, and goodbye for now.